And ever and anon he called the name of Faramir, but each time more faintly to the hearing, as if Aragorn himself was removed from them, and walked afar in some dark vale, calling for one that was lost. And at last Beregild came running in, and he bore 6 leaves in a cloth. "It is Kingsfoil, sir," he said, "but not fresh, I fear. It must have been culled 2 weeks ago at the least. I hope it will serve, sir." Then, looking at Faramir, he burst into tears. But Aragorn smiled. "It will serve," he said. "The worst is now over. Stay and be comforted." Then, taking 2 leaves, he laid them on his hands and breathed on them, and then he crushed them, and straightway a living freshness filled the room, as if the air itself awoke and tingled, sparkling with joy. And then he cast the leaves into the bowls of steaming water that were brought to him, and at once all hearts were lightened. For the fragrance that came to each was like a memory of dewy mornings of unshadowed sun in some land of which the fair world in spring is itself but a fleeting memory. But Aragorn stood up as one refreshed, and his eyes smiled as he held a bowl before Faramir's dreaming face. "Well now, who would have believed it?" said Eorath to a woman that stood beside her. "The weed is better than I thought. It reminds me of the roses of Imloth Melwy when I was a lass, and no king could ask for better." Suddenly Faramir stirred, and he opened his eyes, and he looked on Aragorn, who bent over him, and a light of knowledge and love was kindled in his eyes, and he spoke softly. "My lord, you called me. I come. What does the king command?" "Walk no more in the shadows, but awake," said Aragorn. "You are weary. Rest a while, and take food, and be ready when I return."
"I will, lord," said Faramir. "Who would lie idle when the king has returned?"
"Farewell, then, for a while," said Aragorn. "I must go to others who need me." And he left the chamber with Gandalf and Imrahil, but Beregond and his son remained behind, unable to contain their joy. As he followed Gandalf and shut the door, Pippin heard Eorath exclaim,
"King, did you hear that? What did I say? The hands of a healer, I said."
And soon the word had gone out from the house that the king was indeed come among them, and after war he brought healing, and the news ran through the city. But Aragorn came to Eowyn, and he said, "Here there is a grievous hurt and a heavy blow. The arm that was broken has been tended with due skill, and it will mend in time, if she has the strength to live. It is the shield arm that is maimed, but the chief evil comes through the sword arm. In that there now seems no life, although it is unbroken. Alas! For she was pitted against a foe beyond the strength of her mind or body, and those who will take a weapon to such an enemy must be sterner than steel if the very shock shall not destroy them. It was an evil doom that set her in his path, for she is a fair maiden, fairest lady of a house of queens, and yet I know not how I should speak of her. When I first looked on her and perceived her unhappiness, it seemed to me that I saw a white flower standing straight and proud, shapely as a lily, and yet knew that it was hard, as if wrought by elf rites out of steel. Or was it, maybe, a frost that had turned its sap to ice? And so it stood, bittersweet, still fair to see, but stricken, soon to fall and die. Her malady begins far back before this day, does it not, Eomer?"
"I marvel that you should ask me, lord," he answered, "for I hold you blameless in this matter, as in all else. Yet I knew not that Eowyn, my sister, was touched by any frost until she first looked on you. Care and dread she had, and shared with me, in the days of Wormtongue and the king's bewitchment. And she tended the king in growing fear, but that did not bring her to this pass."
"My friend," said Gandalf, "you had horses, and deeds of arms, and the free fields. But she, born in the body of a maid, had a spirit and courage at least the match of yours.
Yet she was doomed to wait upon an old man whom she loved as a father, and watch him falling into a mean, dishonoured dotage. And her part seemed to her more ignoble than that of the staff he leaned on. Think you that Wormtongue had poison only for Theoden's ears? Dotard! What is the house of Aeol but a thatched barn where brigands drink in the reek, and their brats roll on the floor among their dogs? Have you not heard those words before? Saruman spoke them, the teacher of Wormtongue. Though I do not doubt that Wormtongue at home wrapped their meaning in terms more cunning. My lord, if your sister's love for you, and her will still bent to her duty, had not restrained her lips, you might have heard even such things as these escape them. But who knows what she spoke to the darkness, alone, in the bitter watches of the night, when all her life seemed shrinking, and the walls of her bower closing in about her, a hutch to trammel some wild thing in? Then Eomer was silent, and looked on his sister, as if pondering anew all the days of their past life together. But Aragorn said, I saw also what you saw, Eomer. Few other griefs amid the ill chances of this world have more bitterness and shame for a man's heart than to behold the love of a lady so fair and brave that cannot be returned. Sorrow and pity have followed me ever since I left her desperate in Dunharrow and rode to the paths of the dead. And no fear upon that way was so present as the fear for what might befall her. And yet, Eomer, I say to you that she loves you more truly than me. For you she loves and knows, but in me she loves only a shadow and a thought, a hope of glory and great deeds, and lands far from the fields of Rohan. I have, maybe, the power to heal her body, and to recall her from the dark valley. But to what she will awake, hope or forgetfulness or despair, I don't know. And if to despair, then she will die, unless other healing comes, which I cannot bring. Alas! For her deeds have set her among the queens of great renown. Then Aragorn stooped and looked in her face, and it was indeed white as a lily, cold as frost, and hard as graven stone. But he bent and kissed her on the brow, and called her softly, saying, Eowyn, Eomund's daughter, awake, for your enemy has passed away. She didn't stir, but now she began again to breathe deeply, so that her breast rose and fell beneath the white linen of the sheet. Once more Aragorn bruised 2 leaves of Arthelas, and cast them into steaming water. And he laved her brow with it, and her right arm lying cold and nerveless on the coverlet. Then, whether Aragorn had indeed some forgotten power of westerness, or whether it was but his words of the Lady Eowyn that wrought on them, as the sweet influence of the herb stole about the chamber, it seemed to those who stood by that a keen wind blew through the window, and it bore no scent, but was an air wholly fresh and clean and young, as if it had not before been breathed by any living thing, and came new-made from snowy mountains high beneath a dome of stars, or from shores of silver far away, washed by seas of foam. Awake! Eowyn, Lady of Rohan, said Aragorn again, and he took her right hand in his, and felt it warm with life returning. Awake, the shadow is gone, and all darkness is washed clean. Then he laid her hand in Eomer's, and stepped away. Call her, he said, and he passed silently from the chamber. Eowyn, Eowyn, cried Eomer amid his tears. But she opened her eyes and said, Eomer, what joy is this? For they said that you were slain. Nay, but that was only the dark voices in my dream. How long have I been dreaming? Not long, my sister, said Eomer, but think no more on it. I am strangely weary, she said. I must rest a little, but tell me, what of the Lord of the Mark? Alas!
Do not tell me that that was a dream, for I know that it was not. He is dead as he foresaw.
He is dead, said Eomer, but he bade me say farewell to Eowyn, dearer than daughter. He lies now in great honour in the citadel of Gondor.
That is grievous, she said,
and yet it is good beyond all that I dared hope in the dark days, when it seemed that the house of Eol was sunk in honour less than any shepherd's cot. And what of the king's esquire, the halfling?
Eomer, you shall make him a knight of the Riddermark, for he is valiant.
He lies nearby in this house, and I will go to him, said Gandalf. Eomer shall stay here for a while, but don't speak yet of war or woe until you're made whole again. Great gladness it is to see you wake again to health and hope, so valiant a lady.
To health, said Eowyn. It may be so, at least while there is an empty saddle of some fallen rider that I can fill, and there are deeds to do. But to hope, I don't know.
Gandalf and Pippin came to Merry's room, and there they found Aragorn standing by the bed.
"Poor old Merry!"
cried Pippin, and he ran to the bedside, for it seemed to him that his friend looked worse, and a greyness was in his face, as if a weight of years of sorrow lay on him, and suddenly a fear seized Pippin that Merry would die.
"Do not be afraid," said Aragorn. "I came in time, and I've called him back. He's weary now, and grieved, and he's taken a hurt like the Lady Eowyn, daring to smite that deadly thing. But these evils can be amended, so strong and gay a spirit is in him. His grief he will not forget, but it won't darken his heart. It will teach him wisdom." Then Aragorn laid his hand on Merry's head, and passing his hand gently through the brown curls, he touched the eyelids and called him by name. And when the fragrance of Arthelus stole through the room, like the scent of orchards, and of heather in the sunshine full of bees, suddenly Merry awoke, and he said,
"I'm hungry. What's the time?"
"Past supper time now," said Pippin, "though I dare say I could bring you something, if they'll let me."
"They will indeed," said Gandalf, "and anything else that this rider of Rohan may desire, if it can be found in Minas Tirith, where his name is in honour."
"Good," said Merry.
"Then I'd like supper first, and after that a pipe."
At that his face clouded. "No, not a pipe. I don't think I'll smoke again."
"Why not?" said Pippin.
"Well," answered Merry slowly, "he's dead. It's brought it all back to me. Almost the last thing he ever said. I shan't ever be able to smoke again without thinking of him, and that day, Pippin, when he rode up to Isengard and was so polite."
"Smoke, then, and think of him," said Aragorn. "For here was a gentle heart and a great king that kept his oaths, and he rose out of the shadows to a last fair morning. Though your service to him was brief, it should be a memory glad and honourable to the end of your days."
Merry smiled.
"Well, then," he said, "if Strider will provide what's needed, I'll smoke and think. I had some of Saruman's best in my pack, but what became of it in the battle, I'm sure I don't know."
"Master Meriadoc," said Aragorn, "if you think that I've passed through the mountains and the realm of Gondor with fire and sword to bring herbs to a careless soldier who throws away his gear, you're mistaken. If your pack has not been found, then you must send for the herb master of this house. And he'll tell you that he didn't know that the herb you desire had any virtues, but that it's called Westman's Weed by the vulgar, and Galenus by the noble, and other names in other tongues more learned, and after adding a few half-forgotten rhymes that he doesn't understand, he'll regretfully inform you that there is none in the house, and he'll leave you to reflect on the history of tongues. And so now must I, for I haven't slept in such a bed as this since I rode from Dunharrow, nor eaten since the dark before dawn."
Medi seized his hand and kissed it. "I'm frightfully sorry," he said. "Go at once. Ever since that night at Bree we've been such a nuisance to you. But it's the way of my people to use light words at such times and say less than they mean. We fear to say too much. It robs us of the right words when a jest is out of place."
"I know that well, or I would not deal with you in the same way," said Aragorn. "May the Shire live forever unwithered."
And kissing Merry, he went out, and Gandalf went with him. Pippin remained behind.
"Was there ever anyone like him?" he said. "Except Gandalf, of course. I think they must be related."
"My dear ass, your pack is lying by your bed, and you had it on your back when I met you. He saw it all the time, of course. And anyway, I have some stuff of my own. Come on now. Longbottom Leaf it is. Fill up while I run and see about some food, and then let's be easy for a bit. Dear me, we Tooks and Bandybucks, we can't live long on the heights."
"No," said Merry, "I can't. Not yet, at any rate. But at least, Pippin, we can now see them and honour them. It's best to love first what you're fitted to love, I suppose. You must start somewhere and have some roots, and the soil of the Shire is deep. Still, there are things deeper and higher, and not a gaffer could tend his garden in what he calls peace but for them, whether he knows about them or not. I'm glad that I know about them, a little. But I don't know why I'm talking like this. Where is that leaf? And get my pipe out of my pack, if it isn't broken." Aragorn and Gandalf went now to the Warden of the Houses of Healing, and they counselled him that Faramir and Eowyn should remain there and still be tended with care for many days.
"The Lady Eowyn," said Aragorn, "will wish soon to rise and depart, but she should not be permitted to do so, if you can in any way restrain her, until at least 10 days be passed."
"As for Faramir," said Gandalf, "he will soon learn that his father is dead. But the full tale of the madness of Denethor should not be told to him until he is quite healed and has duties to do. See that Beregond and the Perian who are present do not speak to him of these things yet.
And the other Perian, Meriadoc, who is under my care, what of him?" said the Warden.
"It's likely that he'll be fit to arise tomorrow for a short while," said Aragorn. "Let him do so if he wishes. He may walk a little in the care of his friends."
"They are a remarkable race," said the Warden, nodding his head. "Very tough in the fibre, I deem."
At the doors of the houses, many were already gathered to see Aragorn, and they followed after him. And when at last he had supped, men came and prayed that he would heal their kinsmen or their friends whose lives were in peril through hurt or wound, or who lay under the black shadow. And Aragorn arose and went out, and he sent for the sons of Elrond, and together they laboured far into the night. And word went through the city, "The king is come again indeed!" And they named him Elfstone, because of the green stone that he wore, and so the name which it was foretold at his birth that he should bear was chosen for him by his own people. And when he could labour no more, he cast his cloak about him, and slipped out of the city, and went to his tent just ere dawn, and slept for a little. And in the morning the banner of Dol Amroth, a white ship like a swan upon blue water, floated from the tower, and men looked up and wondered if the coming of the king had been but a dream.
Chapter 9. The Last Debate. The morning came after the day of battle, and it was fair with light clouds and the wind turning westward. Legolas and Gimli were early abroad, and they begged leave to go up into the city, for they were eager to see Merry and Pippin.
"It's good to learn that they're still alive," said Gimli, "for they cost us great pains in our march over Rohan, and I would not have such pains all wasted."
Together the elf and the dwarf entered Minas Tirith,
and folk that saw them pass marvelled to see such companions. For Legolas was fair of face beyond the measure of men, and he sang an elven song in a clear voice as he walked in the morning. But Gimli stalked beside him, stroking his beard and staring about him.
"There is some good stonework here," he said, as he looked at the walls, "but also some that is less good, and the streets could be better contrived. When Aragorn comes into his own, I shall offer him the service of stone rites of the mountain, and we will make this a town to be proud of."
"They need more gardens," said Legolas. "The houses are dead, and there is too little here that grows and is glad. If Aragorn comes into his own, the people of the wood shall bring him birds that sing and trees that do not die." At length they came to the Prince Imrahil, and Legolas looked at him and bowed low, for he saw that here indeed was one who had elven blood in his veins. "Hail, Lord," he said. "It is long since the people of Nimrodel left the woodlands of Lorien, and yet still one may see that not all sailed from Amroth's haven west over water."
"So it is said in the lore of my land," said the prince. "Yet never has one of the fair folk been seen there for years beyond count, and I marvel to see one here now in the midst of sorrow and war. What do you seek?"
"I am one of the nine companions who set out with Mithrandir from Imladris," said Legolas. "And with this dwarf, my friend, I came with the Lord Aragorn. But now we wish to see our friends Meriadoc and Peregrin, who are in your keeping, we are told."
"You'll find them in the Houses of Healing, and I'll lead you thither," said Imrahil.
"It will be enough if you send one to guide us, Lord," said Legolas. "For Aragorn sends this message to you. He doesn't wish to enter the city again at this time. Yet there is need for the captains to hold council at once, and he prays that you and Éomer of Rohan will come down to his tents as soon as may be. Mithrandir is already there."
"We'll come," said Imrahil,
and they parted with courteous words.
"That is a fair lord and a great captain of men," said Legolas. "If Gondor has such men still in these days of fading, great must have been its glory in the days of its rising."
"And doubtless the good stonework is the older, and was wrought in the first building," said Gimli. "It is ever so with the things that men begin. There is a frost in spring, or a blight in summer, and they fail of their promise."
"Yet seldom do they fail of their seed," said Legolas. "And that will lie in the dust and rot to spring up again in times and places unlooked for. The deeds of men will outlast us, Gimli."
"And yet come to naught in the end, but mitre beans, I guess," said the dwarf.
"To that the elves know not the answer," said Legolas. With that the servant of the prince came and led them to the Houses of Healing, and there they found their friends in the garden, and their meeting was a merry one. For a while they walked and talked, rejoicing for a brief space in peace and rest under the morning high up in the windy circles of the city. Then, when merry became weary, they went and sat upon the wall with the green sward of the Houses of Healing behind them, and away southward before them was the Anduin, glittering in the sun as it flowed away, out of the sight even of Legolas, into the wide flats and green haze of Lebenin and South Ithilien. And now Legolas fell silent, while the others talked, and he looked out against the sun, and as he gazed he saw white sea-birds beating up the river. "Look!" he cried. "Gulls! They are flying far inland. A wonder they are to me, and a trouble to my heart. Never in all my life had I met them, until we came to Pelagia, and there I heard them crying in the air as we rode to the Battle of the Ships. Then I stood still, forgetting war in Middle-earth, for their wailing voices spoke to me of the sea. The sea, alas, I have not yet beheld it, but deep in the hearts of all my kindred lies the sea-longing, which it is perilous to stir. Alas, for the gulls, no peace shall I have again under beech or under elm."
"Say not so,"
said Gimli.
"There are countless things still to see in Middle-earth, and great works to do. But if all the fair folk take to the havens, it will be a duller world for those who are doomed to stay."
"Dull and dreary indeed," said Merry. "You must not go to the havens, Legolas. There will always be some folk, big or little, and even a few wise dwarves like Gimli who need you. At least I hope so. Though I feel somehow that the worst of this war is still to come. How I wish it was all over, and well over."
"Don't be so gloomy," cried Pippin. "The sun is shining, and here we are together for a day or two at least. I want to hear more about you all. Come, Gimli. You and Legolas have mentioned your strange journey with Strider about a dozen times already this morning, but you haven't told me anything about it."
"The sun may shine here," said Gimli, "but there are memories of that road that I don't wish to recall out of the darkness. Had I known what was before me, I think that not for any friendship would I have taken the paths of the dead."
"The paths of the dead?" said Pippin. "I heard Aragorn say that, and I wondered what he could mean. Won't you tell us some more?"
"Not willingly," said Gimli, "for upon that road I was put to shame. Gimli Gloin's son, who had deemed himself more tough than men and hardier under earth than any elf. But neither did I prove, and I was held to the road only by the will of Aragorn."
"And by the love of him also," said Legolas. "For all those who come to know him come to love him after his own fashion, even the cold maiden of the Rohirrim." "It was at early morn of the day ere you came there, Merry, that we left Dunharrow, and such a fear was on all the folk that none would look on our going, save the Lady Eowyn, who lies now hurt in the house below. There was grief at that parting, and I was grieved to behold it."
"Alas, I had heart only for myself," said Gimli. "Nay, I'll not speak of that journey."
He fell silent, but Pippin and Merry were so eager for news that at last Legolas said,
"I'll tell you enough for your peace, for I felt not the horror, and I feared not the shadows of men, powerless and frail as I deemed them."
Swiftly then he told the haunted road under the mountains, and the dark tryst at Erech, and the great ride thence, 90 leagues and 3, to Pelargir on Anduin. 4 days and nights, and on into a fifth we rode from the Black Stone," he said. "And lo, in the darkness of Mordor my hope rose, for in that gloom the shadow host seemed to grow stronger and more terrible to look upon. Some I saw riding, some striding, yet all moving with the same great speed. Silent they were, but there was a gleam in their eyes. In the uplands of Lomardon they overtook our horses, and swept round us, and would have passed us by, if Aragorn had not forbidden them. At his command they fell back. Even the shades of men are obedient to his will, I thought. They may serve his needs yet. One day of light we rode, and then came the day without dawn, and still we rode on, and Kiril and Ringlow we crossed. And on the third day we came to Linhir, above the mouth of Gilrine. And there men of Larmadon contested the fords with fell folk of Umbar and Harad, who had sailed up the river. But defenders and foes alike gave up the battle and fled when we came, crying out that the king of the dead was upon them. Only Angbor, lord of Larmadon, had the heart to abide us, and Aragorn bade him gather his folk and come behind, if they dared, when the grey host had passed. At Pelargir the heir of Isildur will have need of you," he said. Thus we crossed over Gilrine, driving the allies of Mordor in rout before us, and then we rested a while. But soon Aragorn arose, saying, "Lo, already Minas Tirith is assailed. I fear that it will fall ere we come to its aid." So we mounted again before night had passed, and went on with all the speed that our horses could endure over the plains of Lebenin. Legolas paused and sighed, and turning his eyes southward, softly he sang,
"Silver flow the streams from Kelos to Erwy, in the green fields of Lebenin. tall grows the grass there in the wind from the sea, the white lilies sway. And the golden bells are shaken of Marlost and Alphirin. In the green fields of Lebanon, in the wind from the sea.
Green are those fields in the songs of my people, but they were dark then, grey wastes in the blackness before us, and over the wide land, trampling unheeded the grass and the flowers, we hunted our foes through a day and a night, until we came at the bitter end to the great river at last. Then I thought in my heart that we drew near to the sea, for wide was the water in the darkness, and sea-birds innumerable cried on its shores. Alas for the wailing of the gulls! Did not the lady tell me to beware of them? And now I cannot forget them.
For my part I heeded them not, said Gimli, for we came then at last upon battle in earnest. There at Pelagia lay the main fleet of Umbar, 50 great ships and smaller vessels beyond count. Many of those that we pursued had reached the havens before us, and brought their fear with them, and some of the ships had put off, seeking to escape down the river or to reach the far shore, and many of the smaller craft were ablaze. But the Haradrim, being now driven to the brink, turned at bay, and they were fierce in despair, and they laughed when they looked on us, for they were a great army still. But Aragorn halted and cried with a great voice, Now come, by the Blackstone I call you. And suddenly the shadow host that had hung back at the last came up like a grey tide, sweeping all away before it. Faint cries I heard, and dim horns blowing, and a murmur as of countless far voices. It was like the echo of some forgotten battle in the dark years long ago. Pale swords were drawn, but I know not whether their blades would still bite, for the dead needed no longer any weapon but fear. None would withstand them. To every ship they came that was drawn up, and then they passed over the water to those that were anchored, and all the mariners were filled with the madness of terror, and leapt overboard, save the slaves chained to the oars. Reckless we rowed among our fleeing foes, driving them like leaves, until we came to the shore. And then, to each of the great ships that remained, Aragorn sent one of the Dúnedain, and they comforted the captives that were aboard, and bade them put aside fear and be free. Ere that dark day ended, none of the enemy were left to resist us. All were drowned, or were flying south in the hope to find their own lands upon foot. Strange and wonderful, I thought it, that the designs of Mordor should be overthrown by such wraiths of fear and darkness. With its own weapons was it worsted.
Strange indeed, said Legolas. In that hour I looked on Aragorn and thought how great and terrible a lord he might have become in the strength of his will had he taken the ring to himself. Not for naught does Mordor fear him, but nobler is his spirit than the understanding of Sauron. For is he not of the children of Lúthien? Never shall that line fail, though the years may lengthen beyond count.
Beyond the eyes of the dwarves are such foretellings, said Gimli. But mighty indeed was Aragorn that day. No, all the Black Fleet was in his hands, and he chose the greatest ship to be his own, and he went up into it. Then he let sound a great concourse of trumpets taken from the enemy, and the shadow host withdrew to the shore. There they stood silent, hardly to be seen, save for a red gleam in their eyes that caught the glare of the ships that were burning. And Aragorn spoke in a loud voice to the dead men, crying, Hear now the words of the heir of Isildur. Your oath is fulfilled. Go back and trouble not the valleys ever again. Depart and be at rest. And thereupon the king of the dead stood out before the host and broke his spear and cast it down. Then he bowed low and turned away, and swiftly the whole grey host drew off and vanished like a mist that is driven back by a sudden wind, and it seemed to me that I awoke from a dream. That night we rested while others laboured,
for there were many captives set free, and many slaves released who had been folk of Gondor taken in raids. And soon also there was a great gathering of men out of Lebenin and the Ethir, and Angbor of Lamadon came up with all the horsemen that he could muster. Now that the fear of the dead was removed, they came to aid us and to look on the heir of Isildur, for the rumour of that name had run like fire in the dark. And that is near the end of our tale. For during that evening and night many ships were made ready and manned, and in the morning the fleet set forth. Long past, it now seems, yet it was but the morn of the day ere yesterday, the sixth since we rode from Dunharrow. But still Aragorn was driven by fear that time was too short. "It is 40 leagues and 2 from Pelargir to the landings of the Harland," he said. "Yet to the Harland we must come to-morrow or fail utterly." The oars were now wielded by free men, and manfully they laboured. Yet slowly we passed up the great river, for we strove against its stream, and though that is not swift down in the south, we had no help of wind. Heavy would my heart have been, for all our victory at the havens, if Legolas had not laughed suddenly. "Up with your beard, Durin's son," he said. "For thus is it spoken, oft hope is born when all is forlorn." But what hope he saw from afar he wouldn't tell. When night came it did but deepen the darkness, and our hearts were hot. For away in the north we saw a red glow under the cloud, and Aragorn said, "Minas Tirith is burning." But at midnight hope was indeed born anew. Sea crafty men of the Ethir, gazing southward, spoke of a change coming with a fresh wind from the sea. Long ere day the masted ships hoisted sail, and our speed grew until dawn whitened the foam of our prows. And so it was, as you know, that we came in the third hour of the morning with a fair wind and the sun unveiled, and we unfurled the great standard in battle. It was a great day and a great hour, whatever may come after.
"Follow what may, great deeds are not lessened in worth," said Legolas. "Great deed was the riding of the paths of the dead, and great it shall remain, though none be left in Gondor to sing of it in the days that are to come."
"And let me well befall," said Gimli, "for the faces of Aragorn and Gandalf are grave. Much I wonder what counsels they are taking in the tents there below. For my part, like Merry, I wish that with our victory the war was now over. Yet whatever is still to do, I hope to have a part in it, for the honour of the folk of the Lonely Mountain."
"And I for the folk of the Great Wood," said Legolas, "and for the love of the Lord of the White Tree." Then the companions fell silent, but a while they sat there in the high place, each busy with his own thoughts, while the captains debated. When the Prince Imrahil had parted from Legolas and Gimli, at once he set for Eomer. And he went down with him from the city, and they came to the tents of Aragorn that were set up on the field not far from the place where King Theoden had fallen. And there they took counsel together with Gandalf and Aragorn and the sons of Elrond.
"My lords," said Gandalf, "listen to the words of the steward of Gondor before he died. You may triumph on the fields of the Pelennor for a day, but against the power that has now arisen there is no victory. I do not bid you despair as he did, but to ponder the truth in these words. The stones of seeing do not lie, and not even the Lord of Barad-dûr can make them do so. He can, maybe, by his will, choose what things shall be seen by weaker minds, or cause them to mistake the meaning of what they see. Nonetheless, it cannot be doubted that when Denethor saw great forces arrayed against him in Mordor, and more still being gathered, he saw that which truly is. Hardly has our strength sufficed to beat off the first great assault. The next will be greater. This war, then, is without final hope, as Denethor perceived. Victory cannot be achieved by arms, whether you sit here to endure siege after siege, or march out to be overwhelmed beyond the river. You have only a choice of evils, and prudence would counsel you to strengthen such strong places as you have, and there await the onset. for so shall the time before your end be made a little longer.
Then you would have us retreat to Minas Tirith, or Dol Amroth, or to Dunharrow, and there sit like children on sand castles when the tide is flowing? Said Imrahil.
That would be no new counsel, said Gandalf. Have you not done this and little more in all the days of Denethor? But no, I said this would be prudent. I do not counsel prudence. I said victory could not be achieved by arms. I still hope for victory, but not by arms. For into the midst of all these policies comes the ring of power, the foundation of Barad-dûr, and the hope of Sauron. Concerning this thing, my lords, you now all know enough for the understanding of our plight, and of Sauron's. If he regains it, your valour is vain, and his victory will be swift and complete, so complete that none can foresee the end of it while this world lasts. If it is destroyed, then he'll fall, and his fall will be so low that none can foresee his arising ever again. For he will lose the best part of the strength that was native to him in his beginning, and all that was made or begun with that power will crumble, and he will be maimed for ever, becoming a mere spirit of malice that gnaws itself in the shadows, but cannot again grow or take shape. And so a great evil of this world will be removed. Other evils there are that may come, for Sauron is himself but a servant or emissary. Yet it is not our part to muster all the tides of the world, but to do what is in us for the succour of those years wherein we are set, uprooting the evil in the fields that we know, so that those who live after may have clean earth to till. What weather they shall have is not ours to rule. Now Sauron knows all this, and he knows that this precious thing which he lost has been found again. But he does not yet know where it is, or so we hope. And therefore he is now in great doubt. For if we have found this thing, there are some among us with strength enough to wield it. That too he knows. For do I not guess rightly, Aragorn, that you have shown yourself to him in the stone of Orthonk?
I did so ere I rode from the Hornburg, answered Aragorn. I deemed that the time was ripe, and that the stone had come to me for just such a purpose.
It was then 10 days since the ring-bearer went east from Rauros, and the eye of Sauron, I thought, should be drawn out from his own land. Too seldom has he been challenged since he returned to his tower. Though if I had foreseen how swift would be his onset in answer, maybe I should not have dared to show myself. Bare time was given me to come to your aid.
But how is this? Said Éomer. All is vain, you say, if he has the ring? Why should he think it not vain to assail us, if we have it?
He is not yet sure, said Gandalf, and he has not built up his power by waiting until his enemies are secure, as we have done. Also, we could not learn how to wield the full power all in a day. Indeed, it can be used only by one master alone, not by many, and he will look for a time of strife, ere one of the great among us makes himself master and puts down the others. In that time the ring might aid him, if he were certain. He is watching. He sees much and hears much. His Nazgûl are still abroad. They passed over this field ere the sunrise, though few of the weary and sleeping were aware of them. He studies the signs, the sword that robbed him of his treasure remade, the winds of fortune turning in our favour, and the defeat unlooked for of his first assault, the fall of his great captain. His doubt will be growing, even as we speak here. His eye is now straining towards us, blind almost to all else that is moving. So we must keep it. Therein lies all our hope. This, then, is my counsel. We have not the ring. In wisdom or great folly it has been sent away to be destroyed, lest it destroy us. Without it we cannot by force defeat his force. But we must at all costs keep his eye from his true peril. We cannot achieve victory by arms, but by arms we can give the ring-bearer his only chance
frail though it may be. As Aragorn has begun, so we must go on. We must push Sauron to his last throw. We must call out his hidden strength, so that he shall empty his land. We must march out to meet him at once. We must make ourselves the bait, though his jaws should close on us. He will take that bait, in hope and in greed, for he will think that in such rashness he sees the pride of the new ring lord, and he will say, "So, he pushes out his neck too soon and too far. Let him come on, and behold, I will have him in a trap from which he cannot escape. There I will crush him, and what he has taken in his insolence shall be mine again for ever." We must walk open-eyed into that trap with courage, but small hope for ourselves. For, my lords, it may well prove that we ourselves shall perish utterly in a black battle far from the living lands, so that even if Barad-dûr be thrown down, we shall not live to see a new age. But this, I deem, is our duty. And better so than to perish nonetheless, as we surely shall, if we sit here and know as we die that no new age shall be. They were silent for a while. At length Aragorn spoke. "As I have begun, so I will go on. We come now to the very brink, where hope and despair are akin. To waver is to fall. Let none now reject the counsels of Gandalf, whose long labours against Sauron come at last to their test. But for him, all would long ago have been lost. Nonetheless, I don't yet claim to command any man. Let others choose as they will." Then said Elro here, "From the north we came with this purpose, and from Elrond our father we brought this very counsel. We will not turn back." "As for myself," said Éomer, "I've little knowledge of these deep matters, but I need it not. This I know, and it's enough, that as my friend Aragorn succoured me and my people, so I'll aid him when he calls. I will go."
"As for me," said Imrahil, "the Lord Aragorn I hold to be my liege lord, whether he claim it or no. His wish is to me a command. I will go also. Yet for a while I stand in the place of the steward of Gondor, and it is mine to think first of its people. To prudence some heed must still be given, for we must prepare against all chances, good as well as evil. Now it may be that we shall triumph, and while there is any hope of this, Gondor must be protected. I would not have us return with victory to a city in ruins and a land ravaged behind us. And yet we learn from the Rohirrim that there is an army still unfought upon our northern flank."
"That is true," said Gandalf. "I do not counsel you to leave the city all unmanned. Indeed, the force that we lead east need not be great enough for any assault in earnest upon Mordor, so long as it be great enough to challenge battle. And it must move soon. Therefore I ask the captains, what force could we muster and lead out in 2 days' time at the latest? And they must be hardy men that go willingly, knowing their peril."
"All are weary, and very many have wounds light or grievous," said Éomer. "And we've suffered much loss of our horses, and that is ill to bear. If we must ride soon, then I cannot hope to lead even 2,000s, and yet leave as many for the defence of the city."
"We have not only to reckon with those who fought on this field," said Aragorn. "New strength is on the way from the southern fiefs, now that the coasts have been rid. 4,000s I sent marching from Pelargir through Lossarnoch 2 days ago, and Angbor the Fearless rides before them. If we set out in 2 days more, they will draw nigh ere we depart. Moreover, many were bidden to follow me up the river in any craft they could gather, and with this wind they will soon be at hand. Indeed, several ships have already come to the Harland. I judge that we could lead out 7,000s of horse and foot, and yet leave the city in better defence than it was when the assault began."
"The gate is destroyed," said Imrahil. "And where now is the skill to rebuild it and set it up anew?"
"In Erebor, in the kingdom of Dine, there is such skill," said Aragorn. "And if all our hopes don't perish,
Then in time I'll send Gimli, Gloin's son, to ask for rights of the mountain. But men are better than gates, and no gate will endure against our enemy if men desert it." This, then, was the end of the debate of the lords, that they should set forth on the second morning from that day with 7,000, if these might be found, and the great part of this force should be on foot, because of the evil lands into which they would go. Aragorn should find some 2,000 of those that he had gathered to him in the south, but Imrahil should find 3,500, and Eomer find hundreds of the Rohirrim who were unhorsed but themselves war-worthy, and he himself should lead 500 of his best riders on horse. And another company of 500 horse there should be, among which should ride the sons of Elrond with the Dúnedain and the knights of Dol Amroth. All told, 6,000 foot and 1,000 horse. But the main strength of the Rohirrim that remained horsed and able to fight, some 3,000 under the command of Elfhelm, should waylay the west road against the enemy that was in Anorion. And at once swift riders were sent out to gather what news they could northwards, and eastwards from Osgiliath and the road to Minas Morgul. And when they had reckoned up all their strength and taken thought for the journeys they should make and the roads they should choose, Imrahil suddenly laughed aloud.
"Surely," he cried, "this is the greatest jest in all the history of Gondor, that we should ride with 7,000, scarce as many as the vanguard of its army in the days of its power, to assail the mountains and the impenetrable gate of the Black Land. So might a child threaten a mail-clad knight with a bow of string and green willow. If the Dark Lord knows so much as you say, Mithrandir, will he not rather smile than fear, and with his little finger crush us like a fly that tries to sting him? No, he will try to trap the fly and take the sting," said Gandalf, "and there are names among us that are worth more than 1,000 mail-clad knights apiece. No, he will not smile." "Neither shall we," said Aragorn. "If this be jest, then it is too bitter for laughter. Nay, it is the last move in a great jeopardy, and for one side or the other it will bring the end of the game." Then he drew Andúril, and held it up glittering in the sun. "You shall not be sheathed again until the last battle is fought," he said.
Chapter 10. The Black Gate Opens. 2 days later the army of the West was all assembled on the Pelennor. The host of Orcs and Easterlings had turned back out of Anorion, but harried and scattered by the Rohirrim, they had broken and fled with little fighting towards Caer Andros. And with that threat destroyed and new strength arriving out of the south, the city was as well manned as might be. Scouts reported that no enemies remained upon the roads east as far as the crossroads of the fallen king. All now was ready for the last throw. Legolas and Gimli were to ride again together in the company of Aragorn and Gandalf, who went in the van with the Dúnedain and the sons of Elrond. But Merry, to his shame, was not to go with them.
"You're not fit for such a journey," said Aragorn. "But don't be ashamed. If you do no more in this war, you have already earned great honour. Peregrine shall go and represent the Shire folk, and do not grudge him his chance of peril, for though he has done as well as his fortune allowed him, he has yet to match your deed. But in truth, all now are in like danger. Though it may be our part to find a bitter end before the gate of Mordor, if we do so, then you will come also to a last stand, either here or wherever the black tide overtakes you. Farewell." And so despondently Merry now stood and watched the mustering of the army. Birgil was with him, and he also was downcast, for his father was to march leading a company of the men of the city. He could not rejoin the guard until his case was judged. In that same company Pippin was also to go, as a soldier of Gondor. Merry could see him not far off, a small but upright figure among the tall men of Minas Tirith. At last the trumpets rang and the army began to move.
troop by troop and company by company, they wheeled and went off eastward. And long after they had passed away out of sight down the great road to the causeway, Mary stood there. The last glint of the morning sun on spear and helm twinkled and was lost, and still he remained with bowed head and heavy heart, feeling friendless and alone. Every one that he cared for had gone away into the gloom that hung over the distant eastern sky, and little hope at all was left in his heart that he would ever see any of them again. As if recalled by his mood of despair, the pain in his arm returned, and he felt weak and old, and the sunlight seemed thin. He was roused by the touch of Bergil's hand.
"Come, Master Perian," said the lad. "You are still in pain, I see. I will help you back to the healers. But don't fear. They'll come back. The men of Minas Tirith will never be overcome. And now they have the Lord Elfstone, and Beregond of the Guard, too."
Ere noon the army came to Osgiliath. There all the workers and craftsmen that could be spared were busy. Some were strengthening the ferries and boat-bridges that the enemy had made, and in part destroyed when they fled. Some gathered stores and booty, and others on the eastern side across the river were throwing up hasty works of defence. The vanguard passed on through the ruins of old Gondor, and over the wide river, and on up the long straight road that in the high days had been made to run from the fair Tower of the Sun to the tall Tower of the Moon, which now was Minas Morgul in its accursed vale. 5 miles beyond Osgiliath they halted, ending their first day's march. But the horsemen pressed on, and ere evening they came to the crossroads and the great ring of trees, and all was silent. No sign of any enemy had they seen, no cry or call had been heard, no shaft had sped from rock or thicket by the way, yet ever as they went forward they felt the watchfulness of the land increase. Tree and stone, blade and leaf were listening. The darkness had been dispelled, and far away westward sunset was on the Vale of Anduin, and the white peaks of the mountains blushed in the blue air, but a shadow and a gloom brooded upon the Efel Duath. Then Aragorn set trumpeters at each of the 4 roads that ran into the ring of trees, and they blew a great fanfare, and the heralds cried aloud, "The lords of Gondor have returned, and all this land that is theirs they take back." The hideous orc head that was set upon the carven figure was cast down and broken in pieces, and the old king's head was raised and set in its place once more, still crowned with white and golden flowers, and men laboured to wash and pare away all the foul scrawls that orcs had put upon the stone. Now in their debate some had counselled that Minas Morgul should first be assailed, and if they might take it, it should be utterly destroyed.
"And maybe," said Imrahil, "the road that leads thence to the pass above will prove an easier way of assault upon the Dark Lord than his northern gate." But against this Gandalf had spoken urgently, because of the evil that dwelt in the valley, where the minds of living men were turned to madness and horror, and because also of the news that Faramir had brought. For if the Ring-bearer had indeed attempted that way, then above all they should not draw the eye of Mordor thither. So the next day, when the main host came up, they set a strong guard upon the crossroads to make some defence, if Mordor should send a force over the Morgul Pass, or should bring more men up from the south. For that guard they chose mostly archers who knew the ways of Ithilien, and would lie hid in the woods and slopes about the meeting of the ways. But Gandalf and Aragorn rode with the vanguard to the entrance of Morgul Vale, and looked on the evil city. It was dark and lifeless, but the orcs and lesser creatures of Mordor that had dwelt there had been destroyed in battle, and the Nazgûl were abroad. Yet the air of the valley was heavy with fear and enmity. Then they broke the evil bridge, and set red flames in the noisome fields, and departed. The day after, being the 3rd day since they set out from Minas Tirith, the army began its northward march along the road. It was some 100 miles by that way from the crossroads to the Morannon, and what might befall them before they came, so far none knew.
They went openly, but heedfully, with mounted scouts before them on the road, and others on foot upon either side, especially on the eastward flank. For there lay dark thickets, and a tumbled land of rocky gills and crags, behind which the long grim slopes of the Efel Duath clambered up. The weather of the world remained fair, and the wind held